Wine drinkers often seem to want to know where the wine came from, which vineyard produced the stuff we're drinking. But do wine drinkers ever think about the total picture, where wine came from, period? At some point in history, humans figured out that fruit left alone will ferment, with often delightful effects. And at some other point, like maybe after they woke up, they figured out how to control the process and produce wine. Our guest this hour set himself on a detective story of sorts to find out the beginnings of wine. Kevin Bigos is the author of Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin Bigos has been a journalist for a long time, with a number of years spent as a correspondent for the Associated Press, so his work has been available to run in just about every paper in the country. Kevin also spent time as an MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellow, so there's the science background, too. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me.
So science of wine, is that it? This is purely an academic journey, or do you maybe like wine a little, too?
Oh, I love wine. I learn about things a little quicker when I talk to scientists, and talking to scientists and drinking wine was a great combination for me.
It does sound like fun, and you got to cover lots of part of the world in doing this. You begin in Amman, Jordan, with wine from a hotel room, and it left quite an impression on you. Tell us that story.
It was a complete accident. I wasn't expecting to find good wine in Amman, Jordan, and there was a little bottle from Cremasan Winery and Monastery, which is in Bethlehem, just outside Jerusalem. And I was really surprised that monks were still making wine in 2008, and it was a very good kind of spicy red wine. But I got back to America expecting that I'd buy another bottle and share it with friends, and you couldn't buy it. There was no importer. And I discovered they were using really unusual grapes, Baladi and Hamdali and Jundali. And I'd never heard of anything like that. I'm like, you know, what are these? So that slowly started me trying to figure out what it was I'd drunk that day and what Cremasan was using. And it turns out they're very old grape varieties, some of them, that may date back 2,000 years or more.
So, I mean, did you ever get an idea for how many different varieties of grapes are used to make wine around the world? I mean, just in the first chapter or two, I get a sense that there are way more than we generally regard when we, you know, pick up a bottle for tonight.
There's at least 1,400. Those are listed in a great book called Wine Grapes by Jancis Robison, Julia Harding, and Jose Vuillemot, a scientist I interviewed in Switzerland. But there's probably more than that, but at least 1,400 that we have records of, you know, particular grapes being used in different countries. Some countries like Italy actually have Italy and the Republic of Georgia, 300 or 400 perhaps different varieties.
Wow, that is a lot of different kinds of wine grapes for sure. One of the scientists you talked to is Patrick McGovern at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a fun character to learn about. What is it that he does with wine?
Well, he goes back to, you know, ancient archaeological sites and the old clay amphora that we've probably all seen in National Geographic pictures. But in the last few decades, science has gotten so much more exact that you can analyze faint little pieces of residue left on thousands of year-old pottery and discover what the chemicals were originally, you know, even what some of the spices were in wines made 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. So he uses mass spectrometry and DNA analysis and pretty much every tool you would see in a cutting-edge hospital or laboratory to analyze these ancient grape and food remains. And he's kind of brought the past to life in that way, with real details about what people ate and drank thousands of years ago.
Oh, so he can essentially recreate the menu of a particular meal, in a sense?
Yes, he did that with King Midas's tomb, discovered some of the meats and grains and probably spices that were used to flavor it. And, of course, there was wine remains in the tomb, too. And the Egyptians often buried their kings with vast stores of wine for the afterlife, so there are remains there. We know that the Egyptians drank red and white wine now.
Wow. You know, the history part and the science part, it's hard to figure out which one to head for because they're both so fascinating. I want to go to the science part for just a second because one of the scientists you talked to has discovered that there are is it that fruit flies have the genes that allow them to get drunk?
That is true. and so really winemaking or fermentation goes back probably millions and millions of years when flies and perhaps birds and other animals, you know, learned to process, not learned, but evolved to process alcohol. And yeast, you know, evolved to to allow fermentation, because none of it would happen without the yeast. And I kind of came to see yeast as like a bass player in the rock band. They don't get all the fame, but they're absolutely vital to not just the alcohol, but the flavors. The yeast actually create different types of flavors. It's not just the grape or the winemaker.
So in the process of looking back into both science and history, I mean, does the trail run dry, or at least does it get faint at times in attempting to figure out when people first made wine on purpose?
Right now, it's pretty clear that it was the Caucasus Mountains, which would be the Republic of Georgia or Armenia or perhaps eastern Turkey, about 8,000 years ago, perhaps even 9 or 10,000 years ago. But what's interesting is they haven't been able to find a specific, you know, grape variety that was the first, and that may be because there was so much experimentation going on. It looks like Neolithic people were harvesting and experimenting with grapes maybe as long as 15,000 years ago. So all this experimentation to make berries bigger and taste better and find the best tasting grape began a long, long time ago.
Well, and it's interesting, too, that as you point out in the book, that that looking at laws on alcohol and its consumption help. How far back in time do we find those going?
Definitely back to the Hittites and the Egyptians 3,000-4,000 years ago. And, you know, the Greeks and Romans had, you know, very precise laws. So some of the earliest legal treatises at least mention alcohol and, you know, how tavern keepers are required to accept grain in payment for, you know, beer or wine. There are early prohibitions in Greek laws against, you know, people being a ship captain while they're drinking or being in the army while they're drinking.
Oh, wow. Like the first DUI laws, in a sense.
The first DUI laws are, if you, they even say, you know, that people under roughly 18 shouldn't drink much. Our laws come straight out of that era.
Wow, that's so interesting. Along with so many other things in the book, it is called Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin Bigos is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll take a short break. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is longtime journalist Kevin Bigos, who also appreciates a glass of wine now and then. He decided to explore the history of wine, the origins of wine, and found a lot of interesting things, both in science and in history, archaeology, you name it. There's a whole bunch of things that come into the book. It's called Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about wine through history and in the present day. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I realized as we got a little further into the book, Kevin, that I was working from an assumption that beer and wine have always been separate like now, but were they always?
Maybe not in the beginning. It looks like some of the earliest civilizations made both, and they may have even, there's some evidence that there was a kind of beerish, wineish mixture at times. Even some Northern European societies, fermented, you know, herbs and mosses and things like that. In Africa, there was palm wine. So people have experimented with alcoholic beverages all over the world.
It sounds like you're fairly open-minded about the stuff you put in your own body, but in your travels, was there one particular beverage that you took a sip of and went, okay, thanks?
Well, I was really glad to have tasted a wine in Athens, Greece, that has a pleasing aftertaste of tomatoes, but I would not say that I would buy bottle after bottle. It has a natural tomato taste and aroma, along with the traditional grape taste. So I'm glad I tasted it, but I'm not going to buy a case of it.
Is there actual tomato in that wine?
No, it's an actual flavor. That's the interesting thing. Grapes express hundreds and hundreds of flavors, but there's no additive. No, the grape is managing to express what we call a tomato flavor. There are other grapes that have eucalyptus flavors, and of course the citrus and cherry and tobacco and, you know, chocolatey flavors, all sorts of things. And some of those actually come from the yeast. but the combination of the fermentation and the grapes. And it's because the grapes have a much broader array of genes that can express proteins that basically express flavors. The scientists have mapped out the differences between rice and grapes, which share a common ancestor probably 100 and 125 million years ago.
But so all the times that people talk about, well, you know, I taste undertones of citrus, or I do taste chocolate, or the things you just mentioned, or they call a wine peppery, those things are not added at any point in the process.
Not at all. The peppery compound is actually rhodotone. Scientists have isolated that particular chemical compound. And the interesting thing I learned that I'd never thought of, although it makes sense, is that people experience wine differently psychologically. More experienced wine tasters, parts of their brain will actually light up memory. You know, if they taste something, it'll kick in, hey, I tasted something like that years ago. And it opens up different neural pathways to experience the wine differently. So newcomers and experts do experience wine differently, and men and women have different taste buds sometimes and experience wine differently.
But sommeliers, for example, and you do bring this up briefly in the book, I mean, it's not that they were born with this innate ability to taste wine differently. So they're trained now to recognize different tastes on their taste buds and where it goes in their head and their brain and to figure out what they're tasting.
Exactly. Sommeliers work really, really hard to experience different wines and memorize wines. And there is evidence that, you know, it's not quite right to say that we remember tastes exactly, but our brain does learn things. And some sommeliers, the good ones, have, you know, a tremendous experience of different flavors and styles.
I want to come back to the original story of the book. You in a hotel room in Amman, Jordan, and drinking some red wine and thinking, wow, this is amazing. Cremasan from Bethlehem in what is now the West Bank. You finally got to visit Cremasan itself. How far back does its history go?
Well, there was definitely a monastery there in the 6th century. The one now was built in the 1880s. But all that region right around Jerusalem and Bethlehem, there are hundreds of Bible references to grapes being in the valleys nearby. And there's still, you know, hundreds of limestone wine troughs that ancient winemakers cut into the valleys, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. So I'd say about 5,000 years ago, at least, was when wine was being made in the Middle East.
Wow. And then Cremasan itself was not really meant to be a big commercial venture. Is that right?
Well, they for a long time, they sold a lot of wine locally to both local Christians and Jews and occasional tourists. It went downhill about 15 years ago when the longtime winemaker got ill. And that was an experience for me because I realized that the wine I tasted was made by their old winemaker, and then new winemakers came in. And they're both very skilled but different styles.
So the old winemaker, his secrets left with him?
Exactly. He did not keep things written down. He was really an old-school winemaker, which, you know, I think he came to Bethlehem in around 1950 or so, and there were really no records of exactly how he was making the wine. And he wasn't able to pass it on because he got very sick, and then the younger generation came on after him.
Oh, so you never got the recreation of that great red you tasted in the hotel room in Amman?
I don't think so, although it gets to the question of, you know, what's the difference between memory and what we actually taste. And could I mention, Jeffrey, I don't know if this is too much of a jump, but there's an Oregon angle to the book, too. I don't know if you saw that.
I was going to ask you about the Oregon end of it. Go ahead.
Well, so I'm researching all this ancient wine, ancient winemakers, and I learned that pretty much the only maker of amphora in America, the big clay containers, is in Sherwood, Oregon. Andrew and Andrea Beckham, a young couple who have both a vineyard, but he was a potter by trade. And about 5 years ago, he set out, he thought, well, gee, I could make those. And so he's built a whole studio to make amphora because Oregon's one of the most, I'd say, adventurous and interesting winemaking areas in America. There are a lot of people trying different things, but he's making these huge containers, sometimes hold dozens or hundreds of gallons. Exactly in the style that they would have been made 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, or similar, I should say, to the style.
This is a big clay jar that's very broad at the bottom and then tapers up to the top?
There were different styles. The Greeks made them very narrow at the bottom, and the Romans, so that they could be stacked in ships for sailing all along the Mediterranean. The Georgians and the Armenians make them kind of big and fat and round with a pointed bottom. So they're different styles, but all clay pots.
Well, as long as we're talking about the making of amphora jars in Sherwood in Oregon, I mean, how much have you had a chance to sample Oregon wine? Because that was one of the first things I wondered about as we got into the book, is if you've sampled some of the wares coming from our region.
I have. I think there's a lot of beautifully made wine in Oregon. Andrew Beckham and Andrea Beckham's wine is very elegant. You know, you might think that, you know, wine made in this old clay container tastes very funky, but he's, you know, a serious and very careful winemaker, and he's learned that some of the containers in ancient times were lined with wax, and Andrew's learned that the amount of wax that's put in changes the taste of wine, and, you know, so there are all sorts of, and the amount of firing that he fires the pots changes the amphora and how they breathe and how the wine ferments. So I think he's relearning what people knew 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, but very elegant, very beautiful wine.
You know, that's why it seems so strange that the winemaker at Cremeson was able to keep all that stuff in his head, because it seems that there are so many variables and minute changes in any of them can result in a very different tasting wine.
That's true. You know, part of it, though, is keeping the old native grape varieties. You know, there were hundreds and really even more than 1,000 native grapes all over the world, and many of them were uprooted in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and replanted with French grapes. So a lot of countries, Greece and Republic of Georgia, are sticking with their native grape varieties, and that's what Cremeson had, those Bilotti and Handali and Gendali grapes, that there's really pretty good evidence those were grown for at least 2,000 or 3,000 years, right in that same region, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and Hebron to the south.
We're getting a real history and science lesson on wine from Kevin Bigos, a longtime journalist who spent a number of years working for the AP, also spent time as a Knight Science Journalism Fellow for MIT. His book is called Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, good morning. Fascinating conversation. I want to make two points. You guys were talking earlier about beer, but what does beer, bread, and wine have in common? They're all critical milestones in civilization, and they're all caused by yeast infection. So you might consider civilization as one big yeast infection, man and yeast, cohabitating synergistically. Now, my second point is that if you read the Bible, in Jesus' wedding in Cana, he does something odd. He takes wine and he dilutes it, like one to three with water. And then they serve it to the guests at the wedding. And then everyone comments about how they use the good wine or the bad wine. But my point is this. Wine was actually not just a luxury for the ancient Greeks and Romans and the Middle Easterns, but it was actually a necessity, just as much as our infrastructure for plumbing. In those days, it was unsafe to drink water because you could get bacteria. That the only way to safen water was to either boil it or to add an adulterant that would kill the germs, like alcohol. So what happens is the Greeks would see it odd for us today to just drink wine right out of the bottle. They would see the wine as a necessary adulterant to add to water, so you could render the water drinkable. If everyone drank that water, even kids, because it would be unsafe to drink water elsewise. So everyone was a little drunk all the time.
Thanks for that, Jacob. Appreciate both of those. Kevin?
Yep, that's very true. Interestingly, a number of scientists, you can do DNA analysis of yeast, and starting thousands of years ago, right around 8,000 years ago, when both beer and wine were domesticated, wine yeast and beer yeast and bread yeast separate into different tribes, and they kind of follow wine grapes or beer or bread all over the world. And some scientists do joke that we're really the ones doing the work for the yeast, you know, helping them spread and keeping them happy. And, you know, they're the ones in charge of everything. And as far as diluting wine, you're absolutely right. That was a traditional way to do it in ancient times. I think there are 2 points. One, they did drink wine all the time, so there was probably sometimes a lighter style where you would dilute it, but it was also to kill the bacteria because they didn't understand how water got polluted.
So we were talking about 8,000 years of winemaking, or maybe 6,000. I'm not quite sure what we figured out here, but you actually visited the first confirmed site where wine was made in Armenia. Is that right?
I actually didn't visit the Armenian site. I visited the Caucasus Mountains in Georgia, which was nearby, mm-hmm. which there was an 8,000-year-old site in the Republic of Georgia. So I had Jose Guillermo told me about the site in Armenia that he visited. It's a cave. And that's the one with the confirmed evidence where they actually have the winemaking trough and containers and remains of seeds and pits. They're containers in Georgia from 8,000 years ago.
Wow. And so does it look like this the same sort of process, or has it changed greatly over time?
That's another interesting thing. I've had a couple of very good wine critics point out that you may be familiar with the trend of natural wine, you know, using natural yeasts and, you know, no additives, no preservatives. That's really the way wine was made for 7,900 years. It's just in the last 50 or 100 years that artificial yeast came into use. So you can make wine just from grapes and just let the natural yeast on the grapes do the fermentation, you know, with no other additives. And the alcohol kills the bad bacteria. So if you're just careful how you store it and make it and how long you let it ferment, that's why I believe some of the ancient wine, you know, could have been really wonderful. It wasn't necessarily some terrible plonk.
Plonk, is that what you said?
Plonk. Yeah, that's a kind of slang term for just, table wine.
Right. I've had my sister use that before. So, yeah, this is plonk here. I did notice there's a map in the book about the spread of winemaking from 8,000 BC to 1900 AD. And I guess the thing that surprised me the most was seeing that it looks like France didn't get wine until about 1000 BC, which would mean the rest of the world or parts of the world had it 7,000 years before France, which is now so highly regarded as a place to get wine.
That really surprised me, too, but there's no question the French are newcomers. You know, maybe only 500 B.C. when they really started winemaking. Before that, they were importing it from the Romans and the Greeks. So they came along later, but they've obviously learned really, really well.
They have indeed caught up. Kevin Bigos, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Here's a call from Jeff in Ashland. Welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, good morning. I have a question about wine barrels. And anybody who drinks wine is familiar with the common types of wood that's used for wine barrels. But I was wondering, what are some of the more unusual woods that have been used over the years? And also, any other unusual containers that may have imparted flavor? And what specifically did the flavor change based upon the vessel that it was used? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. Great question. It looks like barrels didn't come into widespread use until about 2,000, maybe 2,500 years ago. There may have been some made earlier, but it was really the clay amphora up till that time. And people have tried different woods. You know, there was probably cypress used in the Middle East. The oak barrels, of course, came into widespread use from France. Cedar was probably used. But every different wood, if you know anything, for example, about woodworking, wood breathes differently. So just like if you make a piece of furniture from different wood, a wine barrel will breathe differently, and even different species of oak will breathe differently. Breathe differently. So that changes how the wine ages, you know, how it ferments, and can change the flavors.
Are there parts of the world, Kevin, where wine is unknown?
And that was also a big surprise to me because, of course, wine is prohibited under Islam, or has been for the last 1,400 years or so. It turns out that just like people drank during Prohibition and just like people smoked marijuana during the 60s and 70s and on through up till now, even in Muslim countries, there was a lot of wine drinking and wine production, you know, up until very recently. The Persians made a lot of wine, drank a lot of wine, and they had a kind of famous saying. They said, well, since it's a sin to have even just one sip, you might as well drink the whole bottle.
Is there a rarest bottle of wine in the world, some little nook of the world where there is just this narrow valley and only one kind of grapes grows there, that sort of thing?
Well, the most expensive bottles of wine have tended to be the famous French wineries that are now being bid on and bought up by Chinese billionaires. So, you know, they're the famous brands, you know, the equivalent of, you know, Cartier or something like that, Domaine Romanée Conti in France. But the interesting thing about all these unusual wines I tasted, often they're surprisingly affordable. Just because they're not famous yet. You know, you can try all these beautiful different native grapes and basically local wines. I call it the equivalent of the slow food movement for pretty reasonable prices, you know, $20 a bottle, something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's good to know. Rather than going and bidding things up to millions of dollars at an auction, lots still to learn about wine. We're not going to get it all in this hour, but we're learning a lot. From Kevin Bigos, the author of Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. We'll come back and talk more with Kevin and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to longtime journalist Kevin Bigos about wine, both the history and the science, both of which are endlessly fascinating. And I'm surprised he made such a small book out of this. It could have gone on for probably several volumes based on all the research he did. Kevin Bigos hit a lot of corners of the world to research Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, with questions and comments and stories to share about wine, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Jay in Trail sent an email and says, could you ask if your guest knows what the extent of the phylloxera disease in the 19th century was? Are there vinifera growing areas that escaped this plague? I've heard that Chateau Ausson escaped. Is this true? And again, this is all from Jay in Trail.
Yes, thank you for that question. There are a few areas that escaped, although it was a devastating plague that spread all throughout Europe and all the way through Eastern Europe and even the Middle East. I visited one vineyard in France, in southwestern France, below Bordeaux, where they have wines 170 years old that escaped. And it appears to be because it was a very sandy little hill that the little phylloxera insects could not dig down in and, you know, lay their eggs and propagate. But other than that, phylloxera devastated winemaking throughout Europe, and they had to replant vines, and there were a couple of decades when they really weren't even sure whether they would figure out a way to survive it. But they grafted the French French vines onto American rootstock, which had natural disease resistance.
Oh, so they actually had to do some hybridization then to figure out what was going to survive.
All of the great French wines that we drink now are basically grafted onto Native American grape rootstock, which has resistance to the phylloxera insect, because the phylloxera actually came to Europe from American imports. So the only grapes that had the natural resistance were the American wine grape roots.
Oh, well, that must have made American grape growers really unpopular at first for delivering the phylloxera in the first place.
Yes, they were hated at first, and then, of course, salvation later. And it was a big crisis of confidence for the French and the Italians for a while, because they didn't know even how the phylloxera was spreading in the beginning. And it took several decades for scientists all over Europe to figure it out and figure out how to combat it.
So did the reconstituted vines deliver different tasting grapes? Were they essentially the same as they'd been before phylloxera?
That is an endless debate. I tasted some wine made from grapes more than 140 years old that did not die off from phylloxera, and I would say it was a beautiful, incredibly elegant wine. But it's hard to say whether that's because of the winemaking or just because they're very old vines. The general consensus is the modern French wines do taste pretty much the same. maybe a slight difference, but no one knows because we can't go back and taste what a fresh wine was in 1860.
Right. Right. So when we get to the whole issue of taste, which of course is central to wine, because people wouldn't drink it today if it didn't taste good. The things that you found that guide people's perceptions of taste are really fascinating, because it's got, we're talking environmental factors like the music you're listening to, right?
Yes, that really surprised me. The scientists did a test where they played either French or German music in the background of a wine store, and they found out that, the background music influenced what kind of wine you bought. And other people, felt that certain types of classical music went best with certain types of wine. The price has a big impact on critics and both average drinkers. If you serve the same wine to people and tell them one bottle costs $90 and the other bottle costs $10, people often say the $90 bottle is far superior, even though it's the same wine.
Huh. So a lot of influences well beyond the taste buds. So let's get to the taste buds, though, because aside from what our brains are telling us, there are so many physical variables in taste of wine. And I was a little surprised to find nematodes on the list you provide.
Yes. Women have often different taste buds and even better taste buds than men, better taste and aroma sensitivity. And people, memory has a real impact on how we experience aromas and tastes. If you make an association with something you tasted in the past, that opens up neural pathways in the brain. So sometimes scientists even say that flavors and aromas really happen in the brain and not in our mouths.
Hmm. But this concept of nematodes changing the flavor of wine, first of all, a nematode is a flatworm, isn't it?
Yes, it's a tiny little soil worm. I'm sorry, I missed that question. Yeah, they believe that affected certain grapes and basically changed, how productive they are. So some of those wine grapes that have been infected by the nematodes perhaps make a more concentrated grape juice, a better wine. But there's an emerging field where all the microbiology of the soil, turns out to be very important. There's a whole community all around those roots of microbes that affect how healthy or sickly the vine is and the type of juice it produces.
Well, and we haven't even gotten into the term terroir, but given that we live in a wine-growing region, we talk about it a fair amount here on The Exchange, and have talked about the influences on terroir, the soil, the geology, the trees, the shade, the direction of the hillside, things like that. And I don't know, has your palate got so discriminating yourself, Kevin, that you can tell which part of the vineyard wine came from?
No, not at all. And I think that's where you find people who focus on one area, whether it's Napa or Oregon or Burgundy or Bordeaux, for their whole lives. And they start to be able to distinguish, different areas one from another. I mean, I can certainly taste expressions of terroir, but, to memorize them all or recognize them all, there's just endless varieties, in every different region of the world. Although, surprisingly, a lot of wine just doesn't seem to express terroir. I mean, it tastes nice, it has alcohol, has some flavors, but it doesn't have that elusive sense of place, which is what all the great winemakers and serious wine lovers are looking for.
We talked a bit about yeast, and I have to say I really appreciate Jacob's comment that all of civilization is a yeast infection when you get down to beer, bread, and wine, and that we are, as you pointed out, that we are doing the bidding of the yeast by spreading it around the world. When did yeast, would you know when it first entered the winemaking process? Adding yeast, not just what occurs naturally there?
Well, the grapes naturally have yeast on them. So whenever a grape in the wild, the skin breaks and then the juice comes out, that's food for the yeast and it'll start to ferment. So it appears that yeast have been around 100 million years or more. And there's some evidence of wild animals and birds eating fermented fruit and maybe feeling the effects. But you needed to have them put in a container to really get the wine. And that's what experts think happened with 8 or 10 or even maybe longer, 10,000 years ago or even more. When people started making clay or containers or wooden containers, if you put a big pile of grapes in and they break and the juice gets in the bottom, those will naturally start to ferment. And it would have been a very mysterious, almost mystical process to ancient people that you got this psychological effect from this juice just from sitting there for a short time.
I can see where some elements of religion enter into this, because you know, you put grapes in a jar and come back in a few weeks and you got wine and, you know, divine intervention or something.
Very much. Those earliest, that 6,000-year-old cave site in Armenia seems to have been both a burial site and maybe even a sacrifice site where they conducted early, you know, pagan rituals around winemaking.
You mean a sacrifice of what?
Humans.
Oh, as part of the wine?
That wasn't such a good marketing pitch. You know, you can see why that faded out over the years to sacrifice people at the winery.
Oh, wow. And any evidence that went on for a long time, or was that perhaps something that the marketers got rid of?
No, there was a lot of evidence for ritual sacrifice in, you know, those ancient societies in the Caucasus Mountains 8,000 or 10,000 years ago. So, I mean, the archaeologists actually found bones. It's not just conjecture. They found the grape pits in one part of the cave and the wine trough, and then human bones in containers of other parts of the grave.
What was it like for you to visit some of these historical sites? I mean, was it does it look like a dusty old place, or is it, you know, could you sense some real sense of history being made there?
You know, one place that really made an impression was one of the temples to Aphrodite on the island of Cyprus. And Aphrodite is the same goddess as Venus. The Romans just appropriated her story and renamed her Venus. And she was supposedly born in the surf off Cyprus and was an original goddess of love and also very associated with winemaking. She fell in love with Aphrodite. She fell in love with Dionysus. So I visited one of her temples there, and it's right on the shoreline of Cyprus. And you look out across the Mediterranean, there's still ancient baths where people would have, you know, sat and drank wine. And you could just imagine the sailing ships on the horizon and, you know, people gossiping and drinking and fighting and doing everything they do.
Well, it's interesting you bring us back to ancient Greece, because there's the chapter on women and wine there, and boy, it wasn't exactly like it was shared equally among members of society.
No, some of the earliest records in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the winemaker in that is a woman, so there's a few suggestions that the earliest winemakers or the earliest tavern keepers were women. But by the time of the Greeks and the Romans, they were starting to, you know, look down on women drinking wine, and it was more for the men, and there were even some terrible punishments that men meted out if they found their wives drinking. But there was also a yearly festival that I think of as almost an early version of Girls' Night Out, where women could go off just by themselves with no men around and drink and talk and just be away for a few days from all the household pressures and the pressures of the men.
Oh, well, that seems entirely fair. I want to ask about is there a single country that has the greatest variety in wines today, and is it France?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Is there a single country that has the greatest variety in wines in the world today?
Yes. It would be either Italy or the Republic of Georgia. Italy, just as they've encouraged slow food and all sorts of great cheeses and breads and everything else, they have a tremendous variety of wines, several hundred really in production in different regions. Sicily is an entirely different world from northern Italy, for example. The Republic of Georgia, too, they have several hundred varieties, maybe even as many as 500. They're not quite as organized, but they're really resurgent. They're, you know, encouraging their production of just their native grapes and not imported French grapes.
Has that been a case in a number of countries where they've decided to go back to the grapes that were native to the region and not use the imported ones?
Greece has definitely done it. Switzerland's starting to do it. Cyprus, Armenia. There's some exceptions. You know, America's an interesting case because, you know, we do have native wine grapes. They've tended not to taste that great, but there's starting to be new experiments. Scientists are crossbreeding American native grapes with some of the European varieties and coming up with some grapes that really make very fine wine.
You mentioned late in the book, Kevin, that you had American wine blinders. I mean, have you discovered or had you discounted U.S. wines versus the good stuff from the rest of the world for a while?
I had totally discounted it, which probably wasn't fair. But American wine grapes just, you know, they produce alcohol and certainly are drinkable. I mean, you can make wine from Concord grapes, but grapes like Vitis arizonica in the Southwest just always had a reputation of having a bad aftertaste. And dating back to the Spanish, the first West Coast winemakers were the Spanish missionaries who brought wine over from Spain in the 1600s. But there are qualities in those American wine grapes that scientists are starting to learn about and winemakers are starting to learn about. So I think that's going to be exciting to see whether there might be a great American wine grape in the next few decades.
So in the course of all the wines you tasted around the world in the process of preparing this book, do you have a favorite in the world?
No, it got harder and harder the more wines I tasted. Although the Republic of Georgia is fascinating. They have really a big spot in my heart because they still make wine in those ancient clay containers in the Quevery. And it's almost like the difference, you know how you can buy apple juice in the store and it's just a filtered kind of clearing liquid, or you can buy fresh pressed farm apple cider. Well, the Georgian wines, the countryside wines, the small wineries are like that version of apple cider fresh pressed on the farm. It's filled with little bits of flavor and aroma and very cloudy, totally different.
Sounds wonderful. The book is called Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin Bigos, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. Our producers, John Baxter and April Ehrlich, our student assistant, Patrick Fitzsimmons, with Darnell Wilson at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.